Hello and welcome to the Blazer's Edge podcast. I'm avid waffle hater Dan Morang, joined by our managing editor, Dave Deckard. Yes, Dave, I got more than a few comments about my breakfast eating habits or lack of waffles in my diet last week. So I figured I'd announce that wholly and certainly. And just a quick reminder to everybody that we can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you're looking for our podcast needs. And without further ado, our glorious leader, Dave Deckard. Dave, how are we doing this week?
We are the one media source that will not waffle, and Morang takes that literally. It's not been a bad week. When we last talked, I believe the Blazers had won one against the Celtics. It was their first win in five games. They followed that up with the expected win against the Lakers, a semi-unexpected win, 50-50 game against the Grizzlies, which was also a win, and then a narrow loss to the Golden State Warriors. So it looks like things are looking up, kind of. What have you seen? Why do you think the Blazers have won three of four?
Combination of a little bit of a get-well game against the Lakers, playing at home. They had 3 days off before that game. Guys are kind of getting healthy, getting in their routine. I think the change of the starting lineup is starting to kind of get through the rotation and how guys are going to feel and be about for the length of the season, I guess. Beyond that, though, it's kind of hard to pinpoint one exact thing other than the very vague. It looks like they care more.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like they care more until they don't. I
mean, yeah, we keep going back to that. I mean, you see the opening quarter against the Warriors, which probably cost them the game, but the other three quarters, they're playing like a team that's easily a top five team in the Western Conference in that time period. And I think that's the frustration. So you can see the extremes and how they fluctuate and...
No, Lord. Top. Yeah. The Blazers, everything you say about the Blazers always has to be in that time period.
It's that caveat.
Yeah. It's like, well, you know what? How about like always? That would be good. I'm ready for some always instead of time periods. But you take what you can get. And obviously, three wins out of four is not bad.
Now, it's an improvement. And the Grizzlies game was huge.
Yes. That one, I definitely liked what I saw. Again, I think the story is not necessarily different. You pick one or two things that just Blazers are really solid at and do not give up on. In that case, interior defense, the Grizzlies scored a lot of points, but at least they made him work for it. And Gasol, of course, went crazy, but they got up in his grill when he got to his favorite spots. So they did not give up on that. They closed out well, I thought. And they kept moving the ball on offense. And you get those one or two things that the team does right, and that's enough to allow their own offense to prevail. They're still not playing a complete game. They're still not playing a world-class game, but they're doing enough to where the 110 points that they score makes a difference instead of just puffing up stats in the loss.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what Portland can do, even against the Warriors. Somebody like Al-Farouq Aminu has got a guy like Kevin Durant all night long, and Kevin Durant's going to get his. But one or two possessions of forcing him to take a contested jumper from 18 feet and instead of letting him dribble into it, or trapping Draymond Green on a pick and roll and forcing a turnover, those are very, very subtle things that can change the dynamic of a game, especially if you do it for four quarters. And those three quarters that we saw of that kind of intensity gave the Blazers a chance, but that one quarter of not doing it, I think that's kind of like a microcosm of the season, where if they aren't on it, you know, at least three quarters of their game defensively, they don't have a chance. But if they do get on it, they can fight with anybody.
Well, and we eternally forget this. I've maintained it for a long time. Unless you are an elite team or a horrible team, games are decided by 3 or 4 points, which amounts to one or two plays, right? And you can say that about almost all of the West. I mean, Golden State winning by 13 a game, that's another level. San Antonio has always been at another level. Surprisingly enough, Houston is winning games by an average of 6 per game. But then the Lakers are lousy. We knew that. The Suns are lousy. Everybody else is within 4 points, plus or minus. That's literally 2 1.5 possessions can turn the game. And that's what's fascinating about the NBA, is that you get these runs, you get these streaks, but it often seems to come down to who makes the right stand at the right time. And the Blazers, that defensive stand at the end of the Memphis game, too. Oh, my gosh. It looked like they were going to blow it. You have Damian Lillard turnover at inopportune time. And all of a sudden, they play 7 seconds of just inspired, tough defense, which is about 6 more seconds than you usually see. And they hold off the Grizzlies with the final stand. Fantastic. Wonderful. You love that. Can they keep it up?
Yeah. I mean, even if you look at the Warriors game, that fourth quarter was stupendous. I mean, what they were able to do was incredible. I mean, they're missing Steph Curry, and I think that's a caveat that has to be recognized here. But you're still talking about 3 guys that are legit all-stars on the court pretty much all the time for them. So it's not like you're playing a subpar team just because they're missing Steph. But what they were able to do to get back into that game in the second quarter, inspired by McCollum and his offensive outburst, but it was also a 20-2 run, meaning the defense was getting it done. The same thing happened in the final 5 minutes in the fourth quarter. Those little things, I mean, if you're doing that spaced over the entire portion of the game so you're not giving up these big runs and these big leads, it's a lot easier to maintain and make a push in the final 5 minutes than having to expend all that energy just to get there in the first place.
So, I mean, the key for Portland, consistency, some kind of consistency, not in every facet, but enough to hang your hat on. We've had enough of it to produce some wins. They've got Charlotte coming up and Dallas coming up, both at home, both with rest. You probably can chalk those up as winnable games. Now, you chalk no game up as a win at this point. But if they beat Boston on the road and Memphis at home, you think they have a decent chance against Charlotte, a decent chance against Dallas. Oklahoma City on the road, then Dallas on the road. Winning both against Dallas would be tough. Oklahoma City always kind of tough in their place.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. The way Dallas is playing right now, is kind of crazy. I mean, Dallas just beat Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well, so did Portland, but yeah, technically. But
I mean, this is after coming off, playing the Spurs. I mean, they're right. Playing inspired basketball right now, and that's the thing. Portland, if you're hanging your hat on Portland getting hot again like they did last year, yeah, the schedule gets a little bit easier, and the teams that they're playing, you know, from the beginning of the season, you expect them to be subpar performers, but those teams are getting hot right now too. So, like you said, there's chalking up a win and winnable games. Portland has winnable games, but I don't think there's anything you can sit here coming up and go, yep, that's a win, that's a win, that's a win. And that's a little disturbing for Portland fans, at least in my case.
Right. I mean, and this is the million-dollar question. Okay, 3 wins in a row for the first time in forever. I mean, they go a month before winning 2 in a row. Does this mean anything? I mean, it will depend on these next, say, 6 games. You have Charlotte, Dallas, Oklahoma City on the road, Dallas on the road, come home, Boston, Atlanta. Those home games are no gimme. Dallas is no gimme, especially on the road. Neither is Oklahoma City. All these games are somewhere in the middle. And can the Blazers reel off 4-2? Then I think it means something.
Otherwise, you're just giving it all back.
You give it all back or just stay neutral. And by the way, you are still way below 500, so you need to do more than just stay neutral. Then check out this insanity, though. After that, you go to Utah on Wednesday, February 15th, and then you have the All-Star break. That's fine, right? But then after that rest, you got Orlando on the road, Toronto on the road, Detroit on the road, Oklahoma City. So that's 4 tough games that, I mean, hopefully you regroup, but what do you want? Obviously you want as many wins going to the break as possible, but it feels like a no-win situation there. If you get on a roll, it's interrupted. If you don't get on a roll, you come back and you're fretting about it for the whole All-Star break, and then you start out on the road
against teams that have beaten you pretty handily.
Yeah, so they better win now. I mean, because it's going to be tougher to make it up. It just March starts out pretty, got a few pretty games, but March is going to be no picnic as it rolls along. End of February will be no picnic. You got to take your wins where you can get them.
All right, so as we're talking about the ups and downs and how everything's going, is, you know, people like us and other people in the media who can react with the ups and downs of the season as it progresses. Now, I've been kind of pegged as the negative Nancy, so to speak, and I'll probably continue to be that guy until I get a overwhelming amount of evidence to suggest otherwise. But across both the local and national landscape, opinions vary on what's going on with Portland and how much this means and how good things are actually going right now. What's your take on it?
Yeah, media goes up and down too much for my taste. I mean, the Blazers are who they were, and who they were was losing most of their games. They've won a few to make that not so bad, but they're still a team who's losing most of their games. I think we're going to have the definitive read on this team by the end of February. And, you know, again, we may already have it, but I think even if they don't turn it around now, nothing that happens in March or April will be that significant. Even if they win out, even if they make the playoffs, it's too late. You know, it's the nail's in the coffin. It's not working. If they can turn it around right now and then take it out strong for the rest of the season, you might believe this was due to health. You might believe this was due to schedule, you know, that was brutal to begin with. Although you can also turn it around and say, well, it's easier now, and that's why they're winning, which there's truth to that. But basically, I find this stretch between now and the end of February will be definitive, that if they don't turn it around now, they're done.
Yeah, it's one of those things where if you look at the amount of games left, and even if they won out, let's just say they won out every single game remaining, where would that put them? I mean, you're not even talking about a top five seed.
Yeah, I mean, but
that's the insanity of this. Like, but even if everything went their way, you're still sitting there going, well, first of all, where was this in the beginning of the season? Second of all, was it really worth it? Because you're still not even getting yourself home court in the playoffs.
Yeah, but that said, now, this is what you always hope for the Blazers. And we should go back. We should rewind to the beginning of the season expectations. Yeah, there are a lot of people saying the second seed is open. Why not Portland? Okay, fair enough. But I don't think anybody expected them to romp into the second seed with a tour de force. You're basically hoping somewhere between the fourth seed and the sixth seed and really strong showing so you can pull an upset, maybe get into the second round again, see what you can do. Those expectations are not entirely gone yet. The fourth seed in home court is certainly gone. It's possible that even the sixth seed expectation technically might be gone. But if the Blazers can win a large majority of their games going out and avoid the Warriors. It's not that the Spurs are a picnic, but
yeah, avoid the Warriors and take the Spurs. Oh, wait.
Yeah, but you know, okay, let's dream that they can climb into the sixth seed. If they could even get there and they did it, they were strong enough to get there, then you'd still say, yeah, this is pretty close. It's couple seeds lower, but their chances are about on par with what we thought they'd be.
Yeah,
but
the problem is that's not going to happen. You're still getting matched with a team that at least we picked probably it'll either be a Utah or a Houston or even an Oklahoma City. I mean, that's basically who you're looking at if you climbed all the way up to the five seed. And at that point, you're still looking at getting a match with a team that preseason we picked to be a better team than Portland.
Can we have the Clippers again? No. I take the Clippers again.
There's a good chance somebody's going to be banged up.
Yeah, well, yeah. There's almost no doubt about that. So let's talk about, I mean, it's been near constant over the last couple weeks, as of course it will be. Trade rumors, the hottest one right now has to do with rumbles in Orlando that they are not entirely happy with Serge Ibaka, and they might be looking to move him. And of course, anyone of any talent that is looking to move has to be associated with the Blazers. Serge Ibaka, obviously this is not a Lillard McCollum trade. If you could go south of that, maybe not cost yourself too much would Serge be a good pickup? And would he be worth the first rounder? Would he be with the Blazers' first rounder this year, I think, is the question, along with talent, of course.
That pick, no, because I still think it could end up being a lottery pick. And mm-hmm. I think we need to run this a little bit and ask ourselves, Orlando, the players that Portland has pulled out of there so far, in Harkless and Napier, both turned out to be pretty decent. I think they've worked out in Portland's benefit. And really, who's Orlando happy with at this point? I mean, you could really go... I'd say everyone save Aaron Gordon is gettable on that team.
Not the happiest place on earth right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not. I mean, Epcot's right there, and they still just can't seem to put the happiness together. And, you know, it's a really weird situation. Serge Ibaka is one of those players that on paper makes a ton of sense as a player that fits exactly what Portland needs. But how old is he? I mean, there's a lot of rumors circulating about how he may not actually match up with his age. his performance is nice. I mean, he's near a career high in points per game. His three-point percentage, attempts, and makes are all career highs right now. So he's a big that protects the paint. He's mobile. He spreads the floor. I mean, if you're checking the boxes, it all sounds really good. But giving up that first-round pick, the thing is, people you got to remember here is that his contract comes to an end at the end of the season. So if you're giving something up for him and you hope to retain him, that means somebody else has to go because you're not getting bird rights with him. You're not going to be able to go over to cap to re-sign him.
Right. Theoretically, he's 27. So, I mean, that would be right in Portland's wheelhouse. He has a fair amount of mileage on him for that age. My issue... with Ibaka, well, there are two of them, really. One is, I'm not entirely sold on his defense, and I'm not sure that's where he wants to hang his hat. And granted, we've talked about players that haven't been great defenders possibly coming to Portland and improving the roster, which I believe he would, by the way. But I think if you get a guy with Serge Ibaka's level of talent, you're expecting him to do more than be a supporting player. And he's expecting himself to be more than a supporting player. And with that expectation would come the need for front court defense, because that's the only thing that's going to turn this around. And I don't think he plays it well enough, frankly, and I don't think he's interested in playing it well enough. And the second thing is, I think he's getting a little star level. I mean, yes, his scoring is up. Yes, his three-point shooting percentage is up. He's also shooting more three-pointers than he ever has in his career, and I think that's where he wants to go. He wants to be kind of that finesse forward. He wants to be that scoring forward. He wants to be that major option. Well, the Blazers could use another option, that's sure, but he's never going to be a major one compared to McCollum and Lillard, and he's not going to help on defense. It just feels a little bit like, well, you're adding frosting on the pie now. It's okay. They're both sweet, but you didn't really need frosting. You needed some kind of whipped cream or something else.
Now,
coffee.
I think I'm a little bit stronger on what he brings defensively, because Portland just doesn't have his kind of presence, even if it's not the, you know, defensive player of the year candidate type defensive performances that he had in Oklahoma City.
Sure.
He still has the ability, and the just shot blocking alone is huge. And his shot blocking's down a bit, which I think kind of shows where his interests lie right now. But at the same time, he's, if you're just looking at, again, just the style of play and how he would fit in Portland, I think it would make sense. But what are you willing to give up, and are you looking to retain him for the future, are the big questions for me going forward.
Yeah, well, let me hit back here for a second, because I don't necessarily disagree with you, but my question is, does he want to be that defender? And if he's not entirely happy with his offensive role, is he going to give you that kind of effort? And that's always been my question about Ibaka. It was kind of a question in Oklahoma City, despite the fact that he racked up the Blazers continuously. When they started going away from him, he didn't look like the same player. Will the Blazers be able to feed him enough offense, enough respect, enough spotlight in order for him to really say, I'm going to give my everything for this team, I'm going to become the kind of defender that turns this team around? I don't see that from him.
See, over the long haul, I think yes. I think they could make it work with him. You would be taking shots away from guys like Aminu, Harkless, Plumlee, which I don't think is a bad thing because I think Ibaka's much more skilled offensively than any of those guys are.
Sure.
But if you're looking for that immediate turnaround change, and here's my take on trade deadline in-season deals. They're not going to benefit you immediately. Unless you were a team that is absolutely stacked, like the Cavs bringing in additional firepower and Channing Frye. It doesn't make any sense for that stretch run. I mean, let's look at Portland's deadline deals over the last 10 years. How many of them have panned out like everybody had anticipated them to pan out? It usually takes another year or, you know, through that offseason to fully integrate into the team and how it all plays out. And Aaron LaFleur is a bad situation just because of what happened with Wes Matthews. But I think had he stayed for the long haul, it would have worked out much better. So that immediate return that a lot of people hope to gain, especially on a team like this that doesn't necessarily have all the pieces in place, isn't going to be great. But if the long term was added into that, I think he's a guy that you make him your third option. He's a guy that could legitimately fill that third option role that Portland's still kind of toying with.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I like his name among Aminu, Plumlee, and I think Ibaka would really bring a new wrinkle. I just don't think it's enough of a wrinkle for that level of trade. He seems like a tweener to me. Not quite a star, certainly not a role player, at least not a transformational star, let's put it that way. And you're going to be, as you identified, getting rid of a lot of players in order to keep him. First of the players, you have to trade for him. One would assume Alan Crabb might be among those given salary, but, you know, they have, and Crabb, frankly, okay, Serge makes $12.5 million, give or take, you know, this season. Crabb makes $18.5 million. Now, Serge is obviously going to get a raise.
He's
going
to get 18 to 20. I mean, that's what he's going to sit in.
So how do you get there? I mean, you have to, even if they didn't have to get below the salary cap to re-sign him, they'd have to get rid of, I mean, they can't luxury tax themselves into oblivion. So, yeah. I mean, you're going to lose players to make that happen. Is Serge worth, say, three guys? Yes, the guys the Blazers have, probably so. But at the same time, he's not going to replace them all.
And that's why I'm leery of giving up a first-round pick, because if you plan on keeping him for the long haul, you need a cheaper asset that's on a controlled contract. With the way the Blazers are right now, and that first round pick to me is as good as gold. Unless you're getting a guaranteed star player in return and you're moving it with like a McCollum or something along those lines, they can't move that pick. They just can't do it with the way that their salary is structured right now.
And let's compare. Let's do a couple ungettable deals that, I mean, we've toyed with because, you know, fantasy, right? But look, if you somehow could trade five players for Boogie Cousins, you do that because he's going to replace everything.
Yeah.
Assuming none of those is Damian Lillard, and et cetera. But yeah, I mean, it won't even matter what you gave up. Hassan Whiteside, kind of the same way. On the other hand, you have guys like, you know, Vucevic, who you don't have to give up that much for, but is still going to give you utility. It's not going to be as much as Serge's, but you didn't pay as much. That makes sense. In the middle of those two is tough territory, and that's where I find Serge. Now, speaking of Vooch, that's come up again, kind of. Orlando apparently is rumbling about everybody. Here's what I wanted. We've talked about Vooch before. We both kind of like him. I have changed my opinion a little bit that the Blazers may at this point be below the Vooch line, where it's, you know, it'd still be a good deal. It'd still be a fine deal. But my question is, if you got Vucevic, what would the Blazers be trying to achieve? Would that be enough to resurrect this season? Would that be a move for the future? Or what conditions would be needed to make that trade successful?
Yeah, I mean, Vooch is a guy that there's no secret that I've liked for a really long time. And I don't think he's the perfect piece, and I don't think he's a guy that's going to solve a million problems. I just think he's a great value player. And anybody who follows me on Twitter saw a retweet that I put out the other day from Hardwood Paroxysm that showed that with Vooch on the court, the Orlando Magic are actually a better defensive unit. That's kind of crazy when you talk about how the deficiencies of Vucevic have become an issue for them. But he's actually been good. His rim protection, his field goal percentage, his defensive field goal percentage in the paint is actually very good. So, and while these analytics don't always tell the whole story, I think there's more to him than a lot of people really want to give him credit for. Now, his offensive game goes without saying. I've always loved it. He's kind of a throwback. And to me, the fact that he's on that controlled contract at a bargain deal under this CBA, I mean, he's making just a couple million dollars more than Maurice Harkless and Myers Leonard. And he's a guy that's a legitimate 18-10 guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, at that value, that's insane.
Perhaps losing Mason Plumlee as well. So you have a ready-made replacement there. You want to talk insane. Okay. If you look at, let's say you went for Vooch and Ibaka. You know the Blazers could trade Allen Crabbe and Myers Leonard to them right now for Vooch and Ibaka and save $3 million?
I mean, that's actually where I was going to go next. It was that, what if pairing those two actually makes sense? Let's throw a theoretical lineup out there. Let's throw Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, Al Farouq Aminu, Ibaka, and Vucevic.
Yeah, I would take it in a heartbeat. Orlando, would they really do that deal? I mean, Crab's 18.5 across the board, pretty much.
And they have Fournier.
Yeah, and Myers Leonard, $9 million through $11 million. That's not bad, but together. I mean, again, together they're making more than those two right now. And even let's say we give Ibaka $20 million and Vooch, that's $31 million for Vooch and Ibaka long term. For Crabbe and Myers Leonard, it's 27, about 28.
Yeah.
It's only $3 million less than what we expect Ibaka to make on the high end.
For guys who you know that what they're giving you, and they're both giving you more than Crabbe and Leonard are giving you right now.
Why do I suspect that the farther we go along, the more these supposed value contracts under the new CBA for the Blazers look a little bit less valuable? Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah. And then the value contracts pre-CBA, I mean, how valuable are they really? I mean, if you look at the way you're structuring a team right now, if you have anybody on those older deals, those things are worth a ton right now, especially if you've got a guy like Vucevic who signed it a year before.
Yeah.
So it's going to run for a couple of years continuous into it. I mean, those guys are worth a ton as far as what they mean to your team and your roster structuring, because look at the Golden State Warriors. The reason they were allowed to get Kevin Durant was because of Steph Curry's contract. Crabbe, I mean, Myers Leonard is almost making as much as Steph Curry right now.
Yep.
That's insane.
And rookie scale contracts. I mean, you talk about Denver and, you know, Nurkic and Jokic and
Below the salary floor.
Yeah, well, and why? Because rookie scale contracts are free right now. I mean, they might as well be. They're like found pennies. Like,
and that's why I'm so adamant about moving the Blazers' first round pick. It's just it's too good of a chip to move, and that's why I don't think.
Although it's going to go up, it's going to go up, so it won't be quite. But you're essentially you're still correct.
Yeah, but that's why I think even if you get some of these trade request proposals that get tossed out there. Well, what if we move somebody like Mason Plumlee or Allen Crabbe or Evan Turner or got a draft pick? Nobody is giving a first-round draft pick in the top 25 for any of those guys because of the value that's associated with them.
Because free players. Another one we got. So, I mean, we're kind of, you're positive on Ibaka. I'm semi-positive on Ibaka, but doubt that he's going to make the difference for the amount of
cost. It would all depend on what Portland gave up.
Right. Well, you know, yeah, that's true of most trades. Vooch, too, we're both positive on him, although, again, he's not the short-term transformational player. You'd have to believe that long-term he really fits with this team. As you point out, wisely, contract would make that happen. Another one that's come up again, it's come up twice now, mailbag from Evan, so Harkless in Philly. A few years back, you were in love with the idea of getting Mirotić. Seems he's available now. Are you still in love? Does he make sense? And the same from William. Bulls are looking to move Mirotić. He'd be a solid pickup. But do they have any players the Bulls would want? We covered this a couple weeks ago.
Really, again, Chicago's a lot like Orlando. Who are they really in love with?
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard a lot of people that I know in that organization that have said that if the right offer came along, Jimmy Butler could be had.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, if you know how Chicago sports work, I mean, this is a city that still has Jay Cutler. Mm-hmm. They don't let go of their stars easily.
Yep.
So, yeah, Mirotić is another one of those guys that, yeah, he's gettable, but it would all depend on what you're giving up and what you're getting in return. You know, yep. You can say that about any deal, but I think if you're going for a guy like Mirotić, you're, again, going for the cost savings. It all depends on what you're hoping to do with it. And right now, if I'm Portland, I'm trying to maximize my pocketbook because they need assets. They need young, tradable, controlled contract assets, and they just don't have enough of them right now.
Well, I mean, Mirotić is having a bad year. I mean, we've got to admit that. I mean, even for Mirotić, he was always kind of experimental. The experiment isn't working, which is why they want to move him. He's making $5.7 million this year. You got a qualifying offer of $7.2 next year. That's pretty cheap, but that's not in the free territory, especially since you're going to have to extend him or pay him more soon. And you'd be doing it like on a speculative basis because I doubt that he will turn around and become a superstar right away. And you have, if you didn't like Ibaka's defense, you're not going to like Mirotić's defense at all. I mean, he is no solution right there. And he might not be able to be a starter in Portland for exactly that reason. But
you're looking to bolster the bench with him is essentially what you're doing, because Portland's bench right now of Crabbe and Leonard, I mean, that's basically the bench players with the way Vonleh and Turner have been moved in the starting lineup. Because I don't know if you – do you really look at Harkless and Aminu as bench players even though they're coming off the bench right now?
Exactly. Well, and this is the point, is that I believe Mirotić – I mean, I love Ed Davis, but Ed Davis has gone into some kind of black hole well and doesn't appear to be coming out.
I mean, he's got a sprained wrist right now, but –
He had a good game against the Lakers, but he's just not. I don't think it's him. I love what he does, but there just might not be a place for him. He's not being utilized right. Whatever it is, would I be more excited seeing Mirotić come off the bench than Davis? Yes, I would.
Just because of the potential that he has.
Mm-hmm. He does nothing but shoot threes nowadays, but that's not necessarily a problem with Portland. The 30% success rate would be a problem, but I could see that going up in Portland.
And the other thing is he can counter to what Portland does have or doesn't have. He can put the ball on the floor at that stretch four position. So that's one of those things that's, I think that's the underlying problem with Portland's roster construction is not enough players that can put the ball on the floor. Heck, you look at what the Cleveland Cavaliers are talking about right now, and that's the lack of players on the floor that can put the ball on the floor. So it's one of those things that you get a guy like that who has that potential and on the relative cheap, and you can see how, even if it doesn't work out in the long run, the flexibility that it gives both on the roster, on the floor, and your salary structure, it's a net gain for Portland.
I'm still intrigued off the bench of Mirotić Leonard like combo. It would probably be a disaster. I admit that fully, but I'd be interested in seeing that because that would be funny. But that said, Myers Leonard might be a player you'd have to trade away to get Mirotić. So no guaranteeing that would happen. But look, the Blazers have too many similar players with similar deficiencies. At least Mirotić has somewhat different deficiencies. At this point, that would be a step up if the Bulls are willing to trade him. And by the way, as the Evan was correct, that I loved him a year or two ago, and I thought he would be brilliant in some ways. Now, that was with a LaMarcus Aldridge-centered lineup with veteran defenders who were actually good at it. It is not the same situation now. He'd be swinging out in the breeze. So I don't love him as a fit as much, but I would sure take a flyer on him still.
Okay, let's go ahead and throw this out there. We're only a couple weeks away from the trade deadline here. If you had to put odds down on Portland making a move where either Crabbe, Leonard, Plumlee, or Harkless are involved, what would you say that the odds are right now?
I think Plumlee makes the odds go way up, because if they don't trade him, I think have got nothing, because I don't see how they could re-sign him.
They mathematically can, but you're talking about paying a lot of money.
Well, I mean, that's why it's not that they cannot theoretically re-sign him. It's just that you're not just in the luxury tax. As I said, I think on the blog, you're not just a luxury tax apron. You're up at the chef's hat now.
And I think you're paying $2.50 on every dollar. I think is about what it was. I think it's like $2.47.
I think they could get to the three, whatever it is. What's the next level? $3.75.
Yeah.
That's just ridiculous. So I don't see that happening. So I do not put it past the Blazers just to eat it and let him go, because they've done stuff like that before too. But I think if anybody's going to move, it's going to be Plumlee. And if Plumlee doesn't move, they've got to have another trade in the offering of multiple players early in the offseason, which they may, by the way, do as well. Now, the others, I wouldn't be opposed to trading him. I think that's certainly on the agenda somewhere. But I don't believe that the Blazers think that a midseason trade is going to do them that much good. If they do make a midseason trade, I believe it'll be either to get rid of an asset they won't keep, like Plumlee, or to get some kind of future assets and or cap relief. So I don't think we're going to see the kind of midseason trade where you go, oh my gosh, this radically improves the team and now everything's okay now.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to go, though. And this is, even Blazers management has kind of put out there that consolidation trade was always on in the cards. Well, if not now, when?
Well, yeah, there's consolidation is going to be consolidating for different reasons than you thought. The implication was consolidation to get better. Now it may be consolidation to avoid disaster or to avoid paying disasters.
Yeah, I mean, consolidation can mean a lot of different things, and my viewpoint on consolidation was always, first of all, a legitimate two-way big man, or a defensive big man that was so overwhelming defensively that his lack of offensive skill could be overlooked, or a consolidation to where you get assets in return. And by assets, again, I'm always going to go back to cheap contracts, cheap potential laden players that you can get more out of.
Yeah. So if you view their roster, the Blazers are kind of sellers. If you buy that their roster has something to sell, they're more in sell mode than in buy mode right now, which is the opposite of what we thought consolidation would be. But I would tell you this, and we'll talk about this more in it, but let me remind you again, this is typical of the way the Blazers operate. They will tell you the potential of what they can do, but they don't really follow through with that potential. Oh, we have cap flexibility. Well, not anymore. And you got the same team you had last year, and now you have no flexibility. Oh, well, we could make a consolidation trade. Yeah, you could, but you probably won't. And even if you do, it's not the kind of consolidation that was implied. They are masters at this. They put out the potential and they let you think whatever you want to think about it, which is always the most positive interpretation. And then it ends up not living up to expectations. But you know what? Go ahead.
And I'll say, I can tell you who's lived up to expectations, but I think you've got something else you want to go with here.
Well, who has lived up to expectations? Go ahead. Go for it.
You know, CJ McCollum on and off the court, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's where I was going, because the one thing that did lead up to expectations, the story of the week, which we have kept in the bag for until now, the culmination, the climax of the podcast, as Bill Walton would say, the greatest event to ever happen to the Trail Blazers franchise. The Blazers bait Chandler Parsons by putting up a video of him airballing a three, and then Parsons fires back on Twitter with "Enjoy the lottery," and then CJ McCollum sweeps the leg and says, "We won the lottery by not getting you." Is that the sickest burn that a player has ever delivered on another player in public on social media, or can anything rival that?
The only thing that I think comes close this year is Joel Embiid on Hassan Whiteside, and that didn't get nearly the play this did. And Hassan Whiteside had said that the way players campaign on social media, it's all a joke for themselves and a joke of something else. I can't remember the exact context of it. But immediately Joel Embiid respond with hashtag NBA vote Hassan Whiteside, basically calling him a joke. Yeah. And I was like, okay, Joel, that's pretty decent. But McCollum just, I mean,
this was not subtle. That was
this was off the top rope. This was yeah. punching your ticket at Royal Rumble to the main event at WrestleMania. It was the drop kick over the ropes in the match. Let's go home.
This was like Sean Stasiak pounding his chest in front of Stone Cold Steve Austin, and he just got Stone Cold stunnered. I mean, it was I think obviously that was great. By the way, I think Parsons' eventual, when it became a fracas, basically he said, hey, this is all good. It's all in good fun, which I think is in the spirit in which it was meant. And I think it's a great, I went after him a little bit in fun. I thought it was great because I assumed we were all joking. We were all having a good time. They seemed to be. The Trailblazers franchise, Chris McGowan, president, put out an apology, said basically that went, no actions can be taken, but that went a little too far. There was some local media kerfuffle about how that was not respectful and blah, 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 which may have been technically true, but might have violated the spirit of the whole thing. What did you make of all that? Was it appropriate? Did you enjoy it? Good for the team, bad for the team, etc.
My whole take on it was that the Blazers social media team did an awesome job, and that's nothing new. They're great at what they did or what they do. And my whole take on the team social media thing, the Houston Rockets, infamously had one where the emoji gun held to the emoji horse's head and said, shh, it'll all be over soon. Yeah. And that to me was hilarious. I couldn't stop laughing. The fact that he lost his job over that to me was insane. And
to me, that one was too far though. I mean, it was like the connotations of not just violence, but kind of like psychopathic, genocidic, violent, it was a little bit too Saving Private Ryan for me. I kind of get that one,
but I can get close. Where somebody comes from, and I can disagree on it on that one. This one to me was just, hey, this is me respecting our guys and our team. You can go ahead and get off my lawn. I mean, that's how I attributed it, and it was hilarious. And Parsons has been one for self-deprecating humor in the past. I mean, he posed in front of the mural they have in the Trailblazers hallway at the Moda Center of Lillard hitting the shot over him.
Right. Well, you know what made it funny, too, is that Parsons walked away from the Blazers. I mean, it wouldn't have been nearly as funny if the Blazers had rejected Parsons. That would be like grinding salt in the wound, especially with the season he's having. But the fact that Parsons chose to go somewhere else and McCollum follows up with, dang, we got lucky. That there's just an irony to that. There's a twist in that I thought made it amazing. I didn't think McGowan's apology was necessary. He's probably overcautious. And I thought it was fun. I mean, it's not the no fun league here. I mean, if they want to go and if it turns out okay, I'd say let them go. I agree. There's a little bit of a bad precedent showing up a player by showing his worst play on instant replay or, video and tweeting. If there was too much of that, that would be a problem. But that doesn't usually happen. And
I mean, that's been there since the dawn of the media age, though. I mean, go to a Blazers game, the Jumbotron. I mean, how often do we see it? I mean, they play the air ball, or somebody hits or throws up an air ball, and you hear a whoosh sound or a wah, 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 wah.
Different audience, though. It's a different audience there. You assume the audience that purchased tickets to go to your game is basically on your side because they've already invested. Twitter is your team, opposing fans, the player himself, et cetera, outside the context of, I get where that might be, quote unquote, a little over the line. But again, how often does it happen? How many times have the Blazers done this? How many times has anybody done it? And it sparked a delightful thing. I think you just quietly say, probably, let's not make a habit of this, but we'll let this one go.
Yeah. To me personally, I encourage it. And I know how this can kind of come off as a little bit brash or immature, but I like that. I like that because it shows a little bit of nasty, a little bit of a rivalry. I mean, I'm one of those guys that wants to see the Gary Paytons of the world come back to the league. I mean, I want trash talking. When somebody bangs a three in somebody's face, I want them to know about it. When McCollum crossed up Durant and Draymond Green the other night and just absolutely obliterated them, got to the rim of the finger roll, yeah, that play was unbelievable, and I was hooting and hollering screaming, but what really had me going was the glare and death stare that CJ gave Draymond as he's heading back up the court with a subtle nod like, yeah, I broke you off really bad, didn't I? I love that stuff. And so when it transpires and gets all the way into social media, I like it, as long as it's not all the time. Just
right.
It's so, well-timed, yeah. and periodic is how I like it.
We can agree that the Twitter championship belt now hangs across CJ McCollum's shoulder, that he can walk down the ramp. That, by the way, it's no longer Joel Embiid either. He had Triple H's entrance, and that was cool, and that made a stir, but he didn't really earn that. He kind of adopted that. McCollum just came out and he earned that belt. I am anxious to see him take on all Twitter comers. Speaking of Twitter, let's skip to this. We had a little bit, is not exactly Blazer related, but kind of. Rudy Gobert and Nicola Batum were having a little chat on Twitter, and Nick said, sorry about your all-star snub, Rudy. Go for defensive player of the year. And Rudy said, hey man, they've already chosen the defensive player of the year. They already know who it's going to be. I'm just going to go win games. What do you make of that? Are these awards somewhat, I don't know, predestined is a bad word, political maybe, as some of the Blazers have said, or, you know, what is it, rigged?
Not necessarily rigged, but the way that social media is utilized now and the way agents and representatives and organizational representatives place stories and have stories run in favor of their guys or against other guys kind of sets the table for this kind of stuff. And without knowing wholly what Gobert is referencing, I can only assume that he's talking about Draymond Green. I mean, how many stories have been written by how many different outlets about how Draymond Green should win Defensive Player of the Year? I mean, if you go Google Draymond Green DPOY, there's probably 10 different stories about the same talking point.
And then Joel Embiid has been getting some play next.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the new... So, yeah. I mean, here's Gobert, obviously in Utah. Doesn't get as much publicity, but still... He kind of has a point, doesn't
His
he?
Impact is unbelievable this year. You look at the numbers he's putting up, he's basically, I mean, if you want to use a Utah Jazz example of a guy who's consistently overlooked, he's Mark Eaton. The way he patrols the paint for that team. I mean, he is absolutely controlling that side of the floor for that team. It's insane. If you go look at all the analytics behind it, just the raw statistical numbers are insane. And you know, for a guy that's in a smaller market, he's not going to get that kind of pub. And he's not, and you throw in the fact that he's an international player. And yeah, with the exception of Porzingis, how many guys are really getting that kind of pub that are international players?
Porzingis is a great name, by the way. Makes me want to order appetizers. I mean, it's just, I'll take the Porzingis. So this brings up an interesting question, though. Okay, obviously we have Lillard and McCollum with all-star quote-unquote snub. We can talk about whether that word applies at some point. But what we've been told or sold is that all-star nominations depend largely on record, at least for the reserves. Or to put it another way, if your record sucks, you can't rightfully make a claim to be an all-star. It's okay if they pass you up for someone whose team's record is better. Should the same be true, for instance, of defensive player of the year? Or should that be so dependent on individual that, you know, even on a really losing team, that the player could be DPOY or all defensive team or all NBA second team or whatever it is?
The thing about the All-Stars, it's so subjective. Even though they've tried to change it around, you can see that it's just kind of weird. And I've heard people say, well, the reason Lillard didn't make the All-Star team is because his defense is so subpar and the team hasn't performed well. Well, what's the case for Rudy Gobert then? He's arguably the first or second best defensive player in the league. and his team is securely in the playoffs and performing as expected.
Yeah.
So what's the problem here? Oh, that's right. The Golden State Warriors have four All-Stars. I mean, just the way it breaks out. And then, of course, they have to throw the cursory All-Star bid to a Clipper, even though, really, I mean, are you going to take DeAndre Jordan over Rudy Gobert?
Yeah. I mean, and that's, here's my suggestion. Pick the most entertaining guys out there. Just screw it. I mean, just
and throw 15 on each roster.
Well, that would kind of help too. Although we'd be arguing about the 16th. This is like the play-in game to the NCAA tournament. Like, wow, you really fixed things. Big whoop. people are now arguing about the 66th team instead of the 65th. But yes, I agree that that would help. But seriously, just. I don't know. I don't want to take it out of the coach's hands. There should be some respect there, obviously. But choose the most entertaining match. This should be, and it is. It's more like wrestling than it is like basketball. I guess we're on a theme right now. Yeah. But, you know, it should be sports entertainment. And so I on that basis, I cannot see where Damian Lillard has missed a single All-Star team, period.
Let alone back-to-back.
Yeah, he's among the most entertaining players out there. His scoring is high enough. Put the guy in. I mean, and like I want to see Utah's shooting guard. Okay, I'd rather see Gobert, frankly, than Gordon Hayward. I mean, not to down him. He's a good player, but come on, who are you gonna buy a ticket to see? That's Gordon Hayward or Damian Lillard. I mean, it's not even close.
Yeah. It's all kind of weird, and it just kind of goes back to this whole politics and social media and how it all plays off. Damian Lillard, by his own right, is a spectacular player, but he's also a brand. And I think that's why the light gets shined on him even more. I mean, outside of us talking about it and probably the Utah market and the real ridiculous hoop heads, who's over here fretting about or worrying about Rudy Gobert not making an All-Star team? Nobody. Yeah. It's not happening.
France.
Yeah, I mean, that's... And you know what? Maybe they should take a page out of George's book and cast a few more All-Star votes.
Well, yeah, see, there you go. Like, they should make international treaties about exchanging votes. Like, whoa, how long until that happens? How long until some, you know, backdoor kind of
internet exchange happens? I mean, this happened
with China.
I mean, yeah. Yao Ming's vote totals were always absolutely
I think Yao Ming still
insane.
Made the All-Star team. I think he's on the ballot this year, on the roster this year, because why? 1 billion people, 2 billion, whatever it is. Yeah, okay. Let's close with this. We have, speaking of entertainment value and brands and what have you, our friends at Hoop Swag have come up with incredible looking Blazers Edge socks. Not Trailblazer socks, Blazers Edge branded socks. Got the logo, got the absolutely cool design, got everything.
As the kids would say, they are fire.
They are fire. They will give you hot feet. Dad joke there. Bad. Okay, anyway. So you can get these, and the key to getting them is that the proceeds go to buy tickets for kids for Blazers Edge Night. Blazers Edge Night, of course, being when we send thousands of kids to see the Blazers play the Philadelphia 76ers March 9th. None of these kids, or a few of them, would get to go without our help. These tickets are donated to underprivileged kids. And when you buy socks, kids get tickets and you get socks. It is a great deal. The deadline for donating tickets for Blazers Edge Night is Friday. We are running out of time. So all of you who have been sitting on the fence, go get yourself a pair of socks. The link is at the bottom of this post. You can get a ticket to a kid that way. You can also donate directly. You can donate one. You can go to donate 10. You can donate 100. We still have more than that many available that we need to get donated. So please follow those links. Please help us out. The kids do not get to go unless you make the tickets happen. So for 3 days now till the deadline is over, please don't wait any longer. Please help us out.
Yeah. If you're looking for a win-win scenario, if you're even close to sitting on the fence, the socks are awesome. I mean, they're legitimately awesome. And we don't have a ton of swag that we do at Blazers Edge. I mean, you can, if you ever run into one of the writers or any of the other podcasters, it's not like we've got a bunch of Blazers Edge gear all the time. So this is like a rare opportunity to score some of this stuff. And I'm probably going to buy like 10, maybe 20 pair.
You too can walk up to Neil Olshey, shake his hand, look him in the eye, and then show him your Blazers Edge socks and see what his expression is. In fact, video that. I will pay you money for that.
We will donate tickets based on the amount of videos of people wearing
those
socks.
Please do not do that to poor Mr. Olshey. But in any case, you know, everyone, all your friends will think you're the coolest with these Blazers Edge socks. They are on fire. Fire, whatever you call them, flaming hot take. They are hot take socks. You can make that.
You too can be Skip Bayless.
Yes, right. You can make, if you're wearing Blazers Edge socks, you can make any Blazer take you want and make it stick. So yeah, go ahead and do that. And
and this is the secret to getting us Chris Paul.
Yeah, the socks. Even Chris Paul wants these socks. It's written in his contract with the Blazer trade. So for Dan Morang, I'm Dave Deckard. Help us send kids and tune in next week. And we love you for listening, and we'll talk to you later.